Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. On this episode, we'll talk about mental health courts with an investigative reporter. Courts are touted as a better way to handle such cases rather than the traditional criminal justice system, but they exist in a patchwork across the state, and there are other questions about their effectiveness. Also, an investigation into an affordable 3D printed housing project in one of the most poverty-stricken areas of the state. The plans that gained so much attention have now come to a halt. We'll learn more about a crisis nursery and the role it plays in its community. On This Week in Illinois History, we'll remember the debut of the first portable Ferris wheel. And a disturbing trend, more young people are taking up smoking. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A pesticide drift near a central Illinois school has prompted calls for prior notification from farmers. Evan Holden has more details.
The Bethel Lutheran School in Morton was hosting a school event outdoors while students were outside. A farmer nearby applied pesticides to his field. A parent says it was a windy day, which caused the pesticides to drift into the school parking lot where the school event was being held. Katie Vandenberg says parents later got an email telling them to have their kids take a shower because of the risk of pesticide drift. She adds she then found an Illinois bill that would address her situation. There's a proposal in Springfield to require farmers to notify schools and parks 72 hours before applying pesticides. That would allow parents to decide how to best keep their kids safe. Vandenberg says the farmer should have known the pesticide could drift into the direction of the school. Vandenberg says if a parent knows there was pesticide drift, then they should file a complaint with the Illinois Department of Agriculture, which she did. She said the agency was quick to respond and start investigating.
I had a phone call from them saying they were sending three inspectors out by noon the next day, which is incredible, and I'm thrilled that that department is acting so actively about something like this, that they really got on this.
Vandenberg says she receives emails when farmers are applying pesticides because she is a beekeeper, and it allows her to put her bees in a safe area. She adds there should be a similar system for schools. Vandenberg says the bill could make farmers double check they have done everything to keep children safe.
If this really was just a mistake, that reminder to the farmer, if we could get this bill to go through, I think that would make a huge step forward in all this and protecting people, because we're not the only ones that have dealt with this.
Vandenberg says the burden should not be on the schools to keep kids safe from pesticide drift. Democratic State Representative Laura Favor Diaz, representing a suburb of Chicago, sponsored the bill. Diaz says it would allow schools to plan around the application of pesticides, avoiding any risk of pesticide drift. Diaz says children need another layer of protection because the American Academy of Pediatrics advises kids to stay inside when pesticide spraying is occurring nearby.
If pesticide applicators are required to take protective measures to keep themselves safe, then it seems to me that we would want to make sure that our most precious resource, our children, are also protected from these pesticides.
According to the Environmental Protection Agency, children exposed to pesticides have weakened immune responses to toxins, which can lead to short-term and long-term effects like birth defects and learning disabilities. Diaz says the bill would give parents the information to make a decision on how to keep their kids safe if a kid goes to an outdoor space at parks and schools near farms. Diaz says Morton is in a unique situation because a parent knew to file a complaint, which does not always happen. She adds the situation could have been avoided if the farmer had told the school he was applying pesticides.
The school could have shifted and pivoted and held the event on another day or in another location, essentially just planned around that so they could have kept children safe.
The bill is not expected to be called for a vote this year, but Diaz says negotiations are still happening. The state representative who represents Morton opposes the bill. Republican State Representative Bill Howder calls it another layer of bureaucracy for farmers. Illinois currently requires farmers to apply pesticides only when winds are less than 10 miles per hour to minimize the risk of drift. The complaint says the Morton farmer applied pesticides during high winds. Howder says schools should have a protocol for these situations instead.
It almost has to be like an emergency response to like when we have a tornado response or another response. How do we get those kids out of danger of the pesticide that's that's in the wind or in the drift?
Howder says the Morton farmer had to deal with changing weather conditions, which would not be addressed in the bill. The Illinois Department of Agriculture and the Bethel Lutheran School declined to comment. I'm Evan Holden.
It's getting harder for farmers to make it to the next growing season. The Midwest has lost more than 30,000 farms since 2017, and the future of farming is looking very uncertain. But a movement that's well underway in Northwest Illinois could completely change how farming looks right now. Jess Savage has more on what's called the farmer-led movement.
It's calving season for cow farmers. Greg Thorin tools around his pastures in an old pickup truck, looking for baby cows that were born overnight that need an identifying ear tag.
That little calf was born this morning, or last night, or... Hi, sweetie.
Thorin is what's called a regenerative farmer. He produces almost everything he needs to raise healthy cows, but he's even more focused on healthy soil. He quit synthetic fertilizers and pesticides cold turkey years ago. That's saving him a lot compared to conventional farmers.
That's the neat thing about regenerative farming is people just share things.
Thorin's always trying something new on his farm to improve the soil. He loves sharing what he's learned with other farmers, which he gets to do with a group called the Joe Davis County Soil and Water Health Coalition. It works together to protect the farming community and farmland. They're all trying new things and sharing what they learned. This work is at the heart of the farmer-led movement. It's offering an alternative to intensive agriculture, which is driving soil loss, water pollution, and financial crisis for farmers in the Midwest.
Change is what needs to happen.
Beth Baranski is the organizing secretary for the coalition.
Farmer-led movement allows people to share the risk and minimize the risk.
Conventional farmers are facing intense pressures to just make it to the next growing season. Even if they wanted to try regenerative farming practices, razor-thin margins make it financially risky to make the switch. But groups like this call on farmers to learn from each other and share the load.
The key is the farmers on their farms, in their fields, figuring out the practices that will work for them to achieve these goals.
And while there are plenty of government programs and grants and incentives that could help in theory, Baranski says many farmers are skeptical about how well they actually work. She said that generally, they're more likely to trust another farmer.
Somebody coming from the corporate world or from an institution, even higher education, and saying this is what you need to do is not as effective as a neighboring farmer who has tried a practice and found it beneficial.
The coalition offers connection and tested solutions to some of agriculture's biggest problems, but it's a slow-growing movement, and so much of the industry is set up to work in opposition to the coalition's goals. Jonathan Kappas is an associate professor of ag policy at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He says the industry doesn't give them the support they really need in this economic moment.
When things are tight and margins are tough, what we've seen historically is farmers tend to push it, right? You push the land. You try to put more land in production.
He says policy coming from the government should make conservation practices easier, so farmers don't have to choose between protecting soil and water and a profit. But he says policies act like a barrier instead. That makes it hard for farmers to move away from conventional practices.
In theory, farmers could just decide to put less nitrogen on. The risk of doing that is pretty significant. So we may make it worse that way, but we're also not addressing those issues. It's almost like paradoxes within paradoxes wrapped in irony.
The farmer-led movement does have some federal backing. The coalition got some seed money from an organization called the Fishers and Farmers Partnership, which uses Congress-appropriated money to support similar projects in the Midwest. So far, they've aided 70 projects with more than $2 million in funding. As Thorin turns his truck onto the dirt road towards home, he says even though farming this way isn't exactly easy, when you think about it, it's pretty simple.
It's not about the people. It's about the farm. It's about the land. It's about the soil. That's why I tell these young people coming with me. I said, it's not about me. It's not about you. It's about the soil.
Now the growing season is starting up. Farmers with the coalition are hosting field days throughout the summer to share what they've learned. I'm Jess Savage.
That story produced in collaboration with Report for America and the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. Parenting is hard, and not everyone has a support network they can turn to when the need arises. Adeline Moy reports on the only 24-hour, year-round child care facility in Champaign County.
The McLennan family lives in Champaign. Parents Alexandra and Christopher and their two daughters.
Yeah. We got our four-year-old, four in May, Allison McLennan, and then the newest addition to the family is little baby Mackenzie, who is 6 months old.
The McLennans keep busy, with nature walks at Allerton, visits to family in the Chicago suburbs, and gymnastics and swimming classes for Allison. But things looked very different in 2024 when Christopher was deployed overseas with the Illinois Army National Guard, and Alexandra suddenly found herself with the full weight of parenthood on her shoulders. She was a full-time student at the time and decided not to wait for things to fall apart before she reached out for help.
You know, instead of waiting for after the fact and seeing if there was, you know, anything that was concerning us then, catching it in the moment. And so we just kept that connection while he was gone.
Once a week, Alexandra would drop Allison, then a toddler, off at the nursery. She'd run errands, catch her breath, and pick her up a few hours later.
Being able to have crisis nursery was, like, big, fundamental to that entire year.
The McLennans are just one out of hundreds of families served each year at crisis nursery. Russell Zillman is the nursery's assistant director of development and marketing. He says that crisis nursery aims to provide an island of safety.
And I think there's some stigmas that if you bring your child in, you know, you might lose custody or something like that. And that's not what we do. We're just there to help you when things are tough. We're there to be a preventative measure.
The most common reason parents come to crisis nursery is because they're stressed out by work, school, or parenting. Other reasons include housing emergencies and medical crises. Sarah Scully helps lead crisis nursery's child care program. One moment that stays with Scully happened during an overnight intake. A child walked in with their family that had been without stable housing and looked at the bedroom.
The little child said, "Yay, we get to sleep in beds." And that just really hung with me larger than life. Like, that is why we're here.
One of the many benefits a resource like Crisis Nursery provides is protection from the long-term impacts of stress on a child's well-being and development. That's according to Rachel Jackson Gordon, a postdoc at the University of Illinois Family Resiliency Center. She says the nursery can function as a buffer, providing children with a break from the stresses of life.
Having a place like Crisis Nursery gives this quiet space to allow that regulation, especially with trained child care providers, and so that they're not constantly feeling like they're in survival mode. It allows the hormones to regulate, right?
Having a safe place for children to go also helps parents, and when a family receives support, it can change the trajectory of their lives. But sometimes, Zillman says, the nursery has to turn people away because they don't have enough help on hand.
You know, one day we'll be at full staff and then we won't be again. And that's just how it goes in childcare.
Zillman says the goal is to serve as many families as possible, and community members can be partners in making that happen.
If you can't give monetarily, that's okay. If you can't spend time volunteering, that's okay too. But if you can just get the word out there about us, if you can just talk to people about what Crisis Nursery does, then we'll be able to serve more families. And with that comes more safe children and less child abuse, which is really our main mission.
Scully says, looking forward, Crisis Nursery hopes to train staff members to provide more specialized care for kids with developmental delays and other needs.
Because it can go beyond just babysitting or daycare care to truly developmentally appropriate care that helps to get kids ready for kindergarten when they're in our care.
Allison McLennan is now about to turn 4. When she visited Crisis Nursery for an interview for this story, she kept insisting to go visit the play floor and asked for a special treat.
Chocolate cake. Great chocolate cake.
Holding newborn Mackenzie in his arms, Christopher tells me Allison just loves this place.
She saw the staff that she recognizes, and they're waving at her. She's waving at them all excitedly, and then she off she ran to go play.
Alexandra says she'd tell anyone feeling the stresses of parenthood to reach out for help.
Needing help is not a failure. Something like Crisis Nursery takes so much off your shoulders and off of your mental weight that it's so worth it after, like, you've taken that plunge and just, and it's not even that much of a plunge. It's really just, you go and meet them, you'll get the feel, and just, you'll immediately be put at ease.
Crisis Nursery is located in Urbana. The crisis line is open 24 hours a day. I'm Adeline Moy, IPM News.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargill. On May 23, 1900, the world's first portable Ferris wheel, known as Big Eli, made its debut. Its inventor, William Sullivan, launched an amusement ride business that still thrives today. Sullivan was born in Rude House, Illinois, in July 1861. He became a machinist by trade and eventually started his own bridge-building company. In 1893, Sullivan attended the Chicago World's Fair, which introduced the world to George Washington Gale Ferris's invention, the Ferris wheel. Ferris was also an Illinois native, born in Galesburg. Sullivan rode the 26-story Ferris wheel and immediately fell in love, but he envisioned a much smaller version, one that could be broken down and rebuilt in only a matter of hours, making it the perfect attraction for anything from small-town celebrations to county fairs. Sullivan worked with machinist James H. Clements, and in 1900 introduced his 45-foot portable Ferris wheel in Jacksonville, Illinois, just 35 miles west of Springfield. The Big Eli was a big hit, and demand soared. In 1906, Sullivan incorporated the Eli Bridge Company to mass-produce his portable Ferris wheels. He later moved the business to Jacksonville, where it still operates today in its original building. In 1954, the company debuted its second most popular creation, the Scrambler. Today, thousands of Big Elis and Scramblers can be found in amusement parks worldwide. And that original 1900 Big Eli that started it all? It sits on full display right outside the company's factory. I'm Clint Cargill, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
We'll talk about mental health courts. That's on the way on Statewide. This is Statewide. Getting treatment for mental illness is often a matter of location. That becomes an even more complicated issue when criminal charges are involved. In Illinois, an estimated 1 in 6 people with mental illness lives in a county without a mental health court. That's almost 2 million people trying to navigate a system that has few tools beyond sending people to prison or psychiatric facilities. Mental health courts have expanded, but the programs are often a patchwork, and where they do exist, questions remain if they're effective and whether program participants are getting the help they really need. The Illinois Answers Project and MindSight News have looked into every single mental health court in the state. The report found the courts to be a promising model with limited funds. Grace Houck is an investigative reporter with the Illinois Answers Project. She joined Elaine Chaw with St. Louis Public Radio to talk more.
So, Grace, you spent months reaching out, as we said, to every single mental health court in the state. What catalyzed that investigation?
Last summer, I was actually driving around Illinois for the Illinois Answers Project. I'm on our state team. We're trying to do more watchdog work across the state. And I happened to be at a farmer's market in Kankakee talking to people about what was going on in their area. And I met someone who told me Kankakee had just launched the state's most recent mental health court. And I had never heard of a mental health court before. And I was curious because prior to that, I had spent about a year and a half reporting on abusive restraints used on people with severe mental illnesses who were being held in Illinois jails. And so coming off of that long reporting project, when someone mentions a mental health court to me, and I had never heard of that, I was just immediately curious to find out what that was. And so for readers who have maybe, or listeners who have never heard of that before, what it is it is part of an umbrella of what are known as problem-solving courts. At least in Illinois, that's what they're called. Elsewhere across the country, it could be something like a treatment court or a diversion court. And it is a specialized docket really trying to target a certain group of people. And there are veterans courts, there are drug courts, trying to connect people with resources through the court instead of incarcerating someone, often repeatedly, and creating these vicious and expensive cycles of incarceration. And so for people who live in Illinois, and including in the Metro East, if you are facing criminal charges and you do have a severe mental illness and you meet other eligibility criteria, you may be given an option. Often that is go to prison for the charges or go through mental health court.
These mental health courts, you've talked about them in the context of states, but they've received support from the federal government, correct?
Yes. So something that really was interesting to me, you know, I had this conversation with folks at the Kankakee County Farmers Market in June. The next month in July, the Trump administration released an executive order, a highly criticized executive order about ending, quote, ending crime and homelessness on America's streets. And there were a bunch of different things in that executive order. But something that I noticed is there was a line calling out mental health courts, saying that they are an effective method of addressing homelessness and calling on the U.S. Attorney General to prioritize funding for them. But what our reporting also found is many of the people who are going through these mental health courts rely heavily on an array of state and federal social service programs, Medicaid, SNAP, that the Trump administration has also been cutting. So our story really tried to kind of point out the irony there of, on one hand, the administration seeming to hold up these courts, and on the other, threatening some funding that really supports the behavioral health system in this country.
Now, Grace, there is skepticism around these mental health court programs, if you will. And among them is Tony Olhausen, and he is the director of research and policy with the Illinois chapter of the National Alliance of Mental Illness, or NAMI. And Tony joins us now. Welcome, Tony.
Good afternoon.
So, Tony, your insights are in this Illinois Answers Project and MindSight News investigation, and you called them, quote, a Band-Aid and a symptom of a larger problem. Why is that?
We see mental health courts being successful when there are sufficient mental health services and other support services available in the community. And we know they're successful because those services exist. And where we see challenges in our broader mental health system, and you've already alluded to some of the cuts of various state and federal programs, mental health does not exist in a vacuum, right? So, you know, when people aren't able to support themselves in the community, when they have a significant mental health needs, you know, we see people struggle.
Mm-hmm. Now, this report describes some of the limitations that a person with mental illness has to face in this situation. You've touched on a couple of them, Tony. And this piece includes, quote, that many of the factors that determine success sit outside the courtroom, and that participants may falter not only because of their symptoms or decisions, but also because they cannot get into treatment, cannot keep insurance, or lose services when providers fall away. How did you, Grace, first, how did you see this playing out in individual cases that came to you, you know, as you were doing this reporting?
In addition to going to all 31 mental health courts in the state for whatever data or information we could get, my co-reporter Josh and I also talked to people who have participated in mental health courts in Illinois. And we found, when we're able to report for the first time, that more than 6,000 people have gone through a mental health court in Illinois. That's only a fraction of the larger number that applied. And then about half of those people graduate, which raises big questions about why. Why are only half of people getting through what can be a year or 2 year long program? And oftentimes there's a lot of challenges a participant is facing already, even beyond what is often co-occurring mental illness and a substance abuse disorder. There are often housing challenges, transportation. We found one study on a mental health court in Illinois that found most mental health court participants were represented by a public defender, and many, 39%, had been homeless at some point in the program. Often folks may have had a driver's license revoked and so really have struggled to even be able to get to the court on time, have to navigate public transit if that exists at all in their area. In many parts of Illinois, it does not. People have to work, and mental health courts are really can be rigorous programs at first, especially in the first couple of phases that take a lot of time, a lot of appointments, showing up, not only just before a judge in hearings, but with treatment providers, with counselors, with a probation officer. So the folks we talk with said that you really have to be able to build your life around this program to be successful. And that can require a lot of social supports too, like family supports, friend supports.
Tony, how have you seen some of what Grace has described play out in people's lives?
Yeah, so I was able to connect with one of our local affiliates that works with participants in mental health courts, and they were able to share with me some insights. There was one participant that they worked with who was set to graduate earlier this year, but unfortunately their condition, just by the nature of their symptoms, experienced a relapse. This person's case management team really was able to step up and wrap around this participant to identify what additional supports this person needed to maintain their eligibility for the program, to keep meeting their benchmarks. And, you know, they were able to help them connect with programs intensive programs in their community that accept their insurance. But that's not always the case, and programs aren't always able to accept someone right away when those services don't exist in the community, or when there are more complex needs, especially housing and transit, that aren't necessarily easily solved.
And even with all of that work and time put in already. Now, Grace, your partner in this investigation was Josh McGee. He is the Chicago Bureau Chief of MindSight News. And yesterday, he spoke with our producer, Danny Wisentowski, about mental health courts and the way that mental health care itself is being treated as an alternative to incarceration.
I have to say that this is something that's helpful, but could it be more helpful? Should it be studied longer? There should be more participants. All of those things seem true. I also get very scared saying anything that, hey, this isn't working perfectly, or everyone's not being saved by this, because we can see how public opinion can kind of switch back and forth to, if you have any kind of issues, if you take any substances, this is your fault and you just need to be thrown away and not seen by society. So that's why it's harsh to say that this isn't a solution, but it definitely is helping people. It's helping individuals get their life back on some kind of good footing. But you definitely can see where there needs to be more interactions. There needs to be more ways to kind of interrupt people with mental health issues or substance issues before they're interacting with the criminal justice system.
Tony, what comes up for you hearing that from Josh McGee of MindSight News?
I think that's spot on. You know, I mean, we have plenty of success stories, but, you know, thinking about criminal justice system interventions like mental health courts, always, you know, the first question that comes to my mind is, why are we waiting until someone's arrested? Folks are experiencing these challenges in their lives. They're experiencing symptoms before they come in contact with a criminal court system. Why are we waiting until, folks are charged with a crime? Maybe because they're arrested, their life has already fallen apart, because if you miss one day of work, you might not have that job anymore. That's the first, a domino that can fall, leading to many other problems. When we're thinking about systems that are chronically underfunded and governments look to spend dollars in the most efficient way, where can we spend those dollars to have the greatest impact? Community-based services doing that outreach to individuals and families, and combating the stigma that prevents people from getting help in the first place. Those can have an even greater impact and keep people out of the criminal court system.
We're talking today about mental health courts in Illinois and a recent investigation into what the absence of these courts in many of the state's counties means for around 2 million residents. We're talking with Tony Olhausen, who's the Director of Research and Policy at NAMI Illinois, and with Grace Hauck, who is the investigative reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. Now, Grace, as part of your investigation, you reached out to the court officials in Madison County and St. Clair County, and those are counties right across the Mississippi River from where I'm sitting right now in St. Louis. And you had issues with getting data on recidivism and even getting a figure for the number of participants was elusive.
Yeah. What's really interesting is in Illinois, I'm used to sending public records requests all the time. We have a pretty good public records law here. It's called FOIA. But our court system is not subject to FOIA. So I really just had to go and ask nicely to each one of these courts if they'd be willing to provide information. And I really found a wide variety in responses. Some courts keep really detailed data about participant demographics, outcomes, how many end up cycling back into the system. This is in rare cases, but some do follow up trying to find out, you know, our graduates and our alumni, how are they doing now, years later? Other courts really don't seem to keep track at all. Many court systems across Illinois are dealing with case management systems that are outdated or don't speak to one another, making it difficult for court staffers to keep track. One person even described kind of like tallying cases by hand on lined paper. So in Madison County, what's interesting is it is one of the earlier mental health courts that took root in Illinois. The first couple were up in DuPage and Cook County in 2004, but Madison came just a couple years later in 2006, and their trial court administrator and deputy chief of problem solving courts were able to tell us that over 100 people have graduated, 119 from their mental health court, and 83 have had their charges dismissed. They weren't able to tell us how many people total had enrolled, so we can't necessarily say what the graduation rate is there. They weren't sure how many people had had their charges expunged, but they're working on keeping track of that data better, because one of the big promises of mental health courts is that if you go through this 1 or 2 year program, you complete all the phases, you could have your charges dismissed and expunged, which is a whole new lease on life compared to if someone is automatically being sent to prison, is going to have a conviction on their record. There needs to be funding and interest and political will and buy-in to study these things.
Your investigation describes Illinois mental health courts as small oases in an otherwise barren desert. Based on the map of Illinois, Madison County, and St. Clair counties, which you've just talked about, they appear to represent a kind of border of that desert, because beyond those counties, you know, the southern part of the state doesn't have any mental health courts. So what do we know about what is happening in those deserts?
We get calls from folks from all parts of the state who are just reaching out to anyone for support. And a couple of months ago now, we received a call from a family whose 19-year-old had been sitting in jail for months because they were experiencing severe psychosis that ended up in an arrest. And instead of being able to go through a mental health court or diverted in some other way, their experience was that they were found unfit to stand trial. You know, so when there isn't a mental health court or other diversion opportunities, then we see people languishing in jails like that. And, you know, at 19 years old, that might be the first time that person was experiencing these symptoms at all. And that's our system's response.
So does this mean that there's pressure on counties like St. Clair and Madison that do have these courts, you know, to receive people from other counties, Grace?
Yeah, that is definitely part of the discussion. So every year, the Illinois Association of Problem Solving Courts, which is kind of like a trade group for these umbrella courts, has a conference. And I went last fall, and they had a whole panel about how can there be more reciprocity across jurisdictions. And I've heard from a handful of counties that they've been able to make it work, but it's not required. You know, current legislation in Illinois allows the chief judge of each circuit to establish a mental health court, but does not require it. I know Tony and NAMI Illinois have called for there to be one in every single county in the state. And that's much harder in areas that don't have any of the resources needed to sustain a mental health court. But something really important we pointed to in our story is that there are very small counties that make it work. So there are three counties, Montgomery, Effingham, and Christian County. Each has fewer than 35,000 residents, and each operates a mental health court. Meanwhile, a county like Champaign, a pretty large county in Illinois, a college town, doesn't have one.
Grace Houck is an investigative reporter with the Illinois Answers Project, and Tony Olhausen is director of research and policy with the Illinois chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. They spoke with Elaine Chaw. We have a link to the story on mental health courts at our show page. We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. We're back on Statewide. Thanks for joining us this week. Residents in Caro at the southern tip of Illinois are looking at an incomplete 3D printed duplex and looking for answers nearly 2 years after a block party celebrated the groundbreaking. Plans that were promised to be a solution to meet housing needs in the economically challenged community have come to a halt. What started as a routine follow-up to update the progress of that duplex turned into nearly a year of investigations. Molly Parker and Julia Rendelman published their findings as part of a Capital News Illinois report supported by ProPublica. Parker talked with WSIU's Brian Sapp about their reporting and where the project stands now.
I spent about 8 months investigating what happened with this plan to bring these new homes to Caro. They were going to print them with a 3D printer, which for those of you who follow that technology, most of us think about these desktop printers that are doing all kinds of super cool things and even in hospitals. And now they make them as big as a small garage and they can print homes. It's really cool technology. And there was this big plan to buy this printer and bring it to Caro, Illinois and start printing homes.
That was the thing that struck me is there was a plan to do 30 homes. I read the headline kind of caught me. $550,000 was lost. Where are we now? Were any of these homes printed? And what did you find out about why?
Yeah, so one duplex was printed in Caro. And my colleague, Julia Rendelman, who also teaches at SIU with me, she and I went down in August 2024. And we went to this huge party. There was a state senator who helped plan it and this company out of Harrisburg, Illinois. And it was honestly one of the best days in Caro. There, you know, those of you who don't know about Caro, it's obviously a town that had once been thriving at the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, and it's fallen on hard times, like much of Southern Illinois. It's just struggled with its economy and a lot of people moving out. So this was just a great day, even though most places probably don't get together to have a big party to build a duplex, right? Mm-hmm. But like when you haven't had a home built, I think it was at least 30 years. I would hear different things, 50, 30, because a lot of this was sort of folklore. They didn't have inspection records that you could go track. But I think it was at least 30 years. No new homes, lots of homes torn down when there was a public housing crisis there. So a lot of people lost housing and had to move out of the city. So it was just a really great thing. And then a year later, we noticed, hey, this duplex never opened. You know, they did print the one. They had said they were going to print the one and then many more. And then no more were printed and the one never opened. And so we thought it would be a really simple story. To be honest, this did not set out to be an investigation. We're just like, hey, what happened? You run out of money, you know, something break. And it just turned into a sort of wild and windy story.
and it did, and it wound. And I would encourage, we're only gonna be able to cover 5.5 minutes of this, so I'd encourage everybody to go read it. It's a really good read. It's in depth. There's lots of like characters, but so it got one printed. What happened with the printing? I read at one point that you found the people that were supposed to be printing. The guy said it was, I can't remember his name, said it was going to be at his, where their location was, he went out back and it wasn't there, and then you found it on a flatbed somewhere?
Yeah, so the printer was just, it ended up at this rural repair shop. My understanding is they built the house, and the walls did go up, so you can go to Caro, you can see the 3D printed house. It is standing. They started working on the inside, because the printers just do the outside, right? Mm-hmm. Like they don't do your plumbing and all the things that go into building a house. Yeah. So they started doing all this interior work, and at somewhere along the way they stopped. And what we were told by the owners that there were cracks running through the walls of the concrete. Now concrete settle, anybody that's poured concrete knows concrete does crack. It doesn't always mean it's structural, but you know, this was a brand new thing, a brand new technology. And what they told me was they weren't sure what the deal was. So they stopped all the interior work, and that printer ended up getting parked at a rural repair shop in Galatia. For those of you around here, it's about an hour north of Caro near Harrisburg. At one of their employees had that shop, and it just sort of sat there. And, you know, I was curious because I had heard they paid like these things are like $1 million, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is not just something any of us can just go out and buy.
Yeah, not the $200 you can buy and, like you said, put it on your desktop.
Yeah, this is not a desktop printer. This is a piece of like of technological marvel to me. I mean, and it really is cool, right? Like to see what's possible with these things. And I think there was this big hope as these 3D printers were coming out that, hey, we can print fast and save money, but it's really new technology. I'm definitely not criticizing the technology. I think these things take time, and hey, experimenting is what it makes America great. But this is really new and unproven. And so what they said was that the ink that came with it, which is like the concrete fill, the solution that prints it, was faulty. Now, the company that sold it said they offered a solution. And I would hear it, like, where it got odd is, like, there was a lot of stories about what happened, and some of them didn't match, and there were some really peculiar things. Ultimately, like you mentioned, I also found out in the course of the investigation that they had tried to order a different printer from a German company that had an office in Texas, and then it was being built by yet another company called Cobot in Denmark. And that printer just never arrived, and I never heard of that. Like, when we were covering the party, we just did a nice story. How cool is this? Like, they're going to print this home, and then they're going to go down the road, boom, 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 and print more. And, you know, comes to find out, like, that the printer is apparently broken, and it's a $1 million investment. One printer never arrived. You know, so we just had a lot of questions, and we learned along the way that, you know, the FBI had been asking questions, too, and... You know, just to be clear, no one's been arrested or charged. Sure. You know, investigations can go on a long time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're concluded and you don't know. Obviously we don't know what's going on with that. But I did know that, you know, they were filing subpoenas at some area school districts in the city of Harrisburg, where the company also did other types of business. So we know they've been looking around as well. And yeah, there's just a lot of peculiarities that came out in the interviews that honestly raised more questions than answers, as one of the folks in the story said.
I wanted to talk, you talked about this party, and I wasn't here in the market at that time, but I've been to Caro a couple times, and I know that, you know, there's struggles, but, you know, they're trying to turn things around and do that. But one of the characters, like I said, your story had plenty of characters. The city itself seems to be a character, but then also the people living in the city. So now that they've had this party, what is the feeling amongst the residents? Like, a couple of times you talked about they were, don't set us up to fail. Don't get our hopes up if you're not going to follow through. Where do things stand now with people in the city?
I think they're disappointed, right? And we in particular focused on one woman who was really excited to move in. And I've known her a long time, Kanisha. She lives in public housing in a one-bedroom unit across town. And that building, it's under repair. It's got a lot of problems. Also, she has to share a bedroom with her six-year-old daughter. And her daughter's getting bigger, and they need some more, you know, she would like to have her daughter have her own little decorated bedroom, right? And so she had been so hopeful to the point that she has some health issues, and it was so hot that day. But she was so excited. She stayed in the heat until she fainted, and she had to be taken to the emergency room. So obviously, she was deeply disappointed when it never came through, because she was planning on putting her name on that list and getting in there. And others in the town would tell me that too. You know, there was people quoted saying, you know, we told them, even though, so they did donate this house, right? So that, and then that was like a thing of generosity. And then I think they had hoped to donate the house and that maybe that would build momentum. What was really peculiar about it though is, like, they signed a contract with the city for 30 duplexes, you know, 29 more. And, but there wasn't real clear how that was going to be financed. It said the city would come up with financing, but I asked the city leaders, they're like, they kind of sprung this on us last minute. There was some mixed messaging from people at the company. And, you know, Caro, like many towns, doesn't have the financing for that. And there's not a lot of financing out there for something like this. So that was the part that didn't quite add up or make sense to me, is everyone was talking at the party about, like, this is a done deal. We're going to have all these homes. And I kind of bought into it too, right? You want to be excited. You don't want to go and question things, even though a lot of things do fall apart in Caro. And ultimately, you know, ultimately this did. Now, I don't think they're out any money. Like, again, it was donated. I think the company is in a tough way because they lost their deposit on the initial printer. The fine print apparently said they wouldn't get that back when they canceled. You know, they went with a different printer company, and then that one didn't work. So here they are, like, $1 million into a bank loan with apparently two printers that are not printing homes. There's no viable business plan for that. So, yeah, just whether it's bad luck or whatever it was, you know, it's just ended up not being what people had hoped it would be. So, yeah, lots of disappointment.
What's next? Or as far as you can tell, what's next?
Yeah, you know, the company had told me they had sort of switched directions away from the 3D printing. And, I had even seen messages going back and forth with company members not long after the Caro House, almost saying, like, we don't really have a viable business plan. Again, that part a little bit peculiar, because you would think they would have gone into this with a business plan. They had told me they thought that they would get, like, developers who were experienced in going out and getting the money. So there's a lot of complicated ways affordable housing's paid for, like through tax credits and things, and they kind of envision those people getting the money and then hiring them. But because it's so new and so experimental, it's not really something that a lot of people are just, like, jumping up and down to do just because nobody wants to be the first. And obviously we saw these problems here with this. So I think for the company, they sort of pivoted and started doing other work. And, you know, and they still owe the bank, though, the money, mm-hmm. and that 3D printer is still in their parking lot. You know, as for Caro, the mayor, they're still very optimistic. They would still love to have housing, and they had the perfect lot to build 30 mm-hmm. duplexes with maybe 15 on each side, or single family homes, whatever. And so he's still hopeful, mm-hmm. you know, that someone will come in and do that. I think what was so hard about this is, like, even though it was a donation, you know, it did have a lot of public officials behind it. Like, mm-hmm. we had a state senator, you know, the governor met with the company owners, U.S. Entertainment Duckworth's office was invited to meet with them. So they had a lot of high level support and attention on it. And it just fizzled. And, you know, they had told this town, even one of the owners said, you know, this was like a God-driven mm-hmm. mission. If you read in the story, like, there was a lot of religious overture in the story, but like, he felt like, you know, a calling about this. And so I think that made it a little bit more offensive, too. It's like, well, God laid this on your heart, and yet you didn't finish the duplex. You know, what's going on? So Caro never gives up. Mm-hmm. I will say that Caro does not give up. But it's a tough go to get affordable housing in our area.
Molly Parker, who along with Julia Rendelman reported on a 3D printed housing project in Caro that came to a halt. A link to that story can be found at our show page. You may have noticed lately in movies and shows that more cigarettes are popping up, and it seems that trend may not be limited to the screen. Rebecca Smith reports from Columbia, Missouri on why Gen Z is reaching more often for a cigarette.
It's Resource Monday at the University of Missouri's Wellness Resource Center, and sophomore Patty Kirtley is handing out free quit kits.
There are products that help with flavor cravings and oral stimulation. So some of these include flavored toothpicks.
Kirtley is an intern for Nick Free Mizzou, a group that's working to reduce tobacco and nicotine usage at MU. She says it's pretty common to find someone smoking or vaping around campus, and research backs that up. According to Partners in Prevention, a coalition of public and private colleges and universities across Missouri, 43% of Mizzou students reported using a nicotine product in 2025, while the average for all four-year institutions was just 28%.
I don't know anyone who uses cigarettes regularly because vapes are convenient and they're small, and cigarettes are, like, aesthetic. Yeah. They're aesthetic and they're, like, sophisticated.
Tianzi Sun is a researcher at Australia's National Center for Youth Substance Use Research. She says the perception that cigarettes are cool or sexy has been carefully curated by the tobacco industry and widely perpetuated by influencers on social media. There are accounts that only post images of celebrities smoking cigarettes and looking, quote, hot and attractive, with no accompanying safety disclosure. Sun says while traditional media platforms such as cable television and magazines are heavily regulated, social media is subject to fewer laws, making it harder to regulate.
We found that only celebrities and social media influencers were predictive of subsequent tobacco use.
She adds they're beginning to see some anti-vaping content online, but it's not cessation messaging. Instead, it's often a promotion of a return to a more masculine, more analog way of interacting with tobacco, cigarettes.
So there is this sense of like an attraction to freedom, an attraction to not taking yourself too seriously, about being a bit reckless.
That's Clay Rutledge. He studies existential psychology at the Archbridge Institute, a right-leaning think tank. He says this is a phenomenon called historic nostalgia, essentially longing for an era that one didn't live through.
Around 2/3 or more of Gen Z adults report that when they engage in this kind of nostalgia, it helps them manage their anxieties about the present and their concerns about the future.
Oh, so it's essential oils only?
Yeah.
You just sniff it.
At Mizzou, anti-smoking interns Patty Kirtley and Danielle Kimmel talk with students who've dropped by. Kirtley says through their grant, they're able to provide nicotine replacement therapies, such as nicotine gum, lozenges, or patches for free.
It's not like all of a sudden when you get a job and you're going to go to work and you're going to be able to like leave your vape behind. You have to like put in the work.
Kirtley says she hopes her fellow students will take advantage of the resource because smoking even the occasional cigarette can make it harder to quit.
Rebecca Smith with that report. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks again for being with us, and remember to join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.